Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Irish Farmers Journal Weekly Podcast.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. Coming up, we'll hear about how to spot blackgrass, and in a week that saw the publication of the climate bill, Minister Eamon Ryan insists farmers should be paid properly for looking after nature. But first up, there has been considerable consternation over Glanbia's announcement that they would be restricting a farmer milk supply during peak months. The Irish Farmers Journal held a webinar with Glanbia this week to find out more. Firstly, here is Glanbia Chair John Murphy describing the background to new restrictions in milk supply, pointing to their friends in Antashka who have used planning objections to create delays in building a new Glanbia plant to process milk.
Totally out of our hands. You know, this was supposed to happen in 2022, just in line for our target had growth in that year. You know, we've been working closely with our suppliers for the last 5-6 years, doing surveys all the time. So we knew exactly where we were and where we had to be, and we were ready for the next phase of expansion. That said, expansion has slowed a bit. Like, we're into a more moderate phase of growth now. But look, thanks to our friends in Antashka, they have appealed this, over the last year and a half. We got planning a year and a half ago, and we still haven't got to the starting blocks. So this is causing a problem. We literally can only manage, we can manage about 100 million of growth of litres over the next couple of next year and the year after. But after that, journeys fall. It's not possible for us to take in anymore. Like, people say, can we not do more with the rest of the industry? I have to say, relations are excellent with the rest of the dairies in Ireland. And we, you know, we export a lot of milk to those every year, and we'll be doing so over the period of this as well. The problem is, Jack, you know, we're full, but actually Ireland is full as well. And that's where the problem is. So, as I say, we expect, hopefully, best case scenario now is we'll have this plant in 2024. We'll be up and running. So the restrictions we're announcing now, it's for 11 or 12 weeks of the year. We've 38 or 9 weeks, and there's unlimited growth. And that's something that's been forced on us. We certainly don't want to be here. But like, as a board, we have to deal with the cards we've been played. We have to deal with the situation. We can't run away. We have to do what we can to lead our farmers through this, to lead our company through this. It's a short period, and we will do our utmost to try and minimize impact. And as you said in the opening, there will be some people impacted. And we're very conscious of people who have borrowed money and are maybe caught on the hook now. So we're going to do our utmost. But let's be honest, we won't be able to facilitate everybody.
However, my colleague Aidan Brennan had done some analysis on how farmers on the ground would be impacted.
You know, 70% of suppliers won't be affected, but my own thinking of it that, you know, a lot of those farmers will be affected maybe in a smaller way, because the supply profile is going to catch a lot of people so that are supplying more than, we say, the Glanbia average at peak. So they might be penalised if they supply more than that. So I think that's just maybe a clarification we need later. But I've looked at a number of case studies. So I take a typical farmer currently milking 120 cows. This is case study A, and going to increase to 140 cows, will have to pay a fine, this penalty that Sean talks about, of about roughly 3,500 in 2022. That decreases then in subsequent years because that 2.5% compound growth is added in. So it drops down to about 2,800 in 2023, and then around 2,200 in 2024. So that's if the farmer doesn't reduce production, they're going to drive on and pay the fine. Case study B then is a new
entrant. Just to be clear now, when you say a fine, that's the reduction in the milk price that was paid, that's paid to them for that volume over and above that peak.
Yes, yeah. So it's a fine. It's you know, you're not getting paid the penalty. There's different names on it. You know, you can call it what you want, but either way, you're not getting paid for the milk that you supply.
Yeah. Now, and I'd say it's a minimum fine, Aidan. Like, it could turn into a you could be charged for supplying that milk if everyone does what happened in that case study A.
Yeah, that's the big risk there. And Sean has kind of alluded to the fact that, you know, this could be tweaked and changed. And in the event that everyone goes down this road, as you say, and Glenbey can't process the milk, are they going to start charging you for taking the milk, which is separate to not be getting paid? It's just different to being paid less. You're now actually going to be charged for it. And what happens then? Are farmers going to end up dumping milk, or what happens in that situation? You know, there's uncertainty there. Case study B then is a new entrant. A new entrant to dairying with a large land, can milk 200 cows. Now that new entrant is going to be limited to 100 cows. And Glenbey are saying here they do not have to collect over and above what the average peak supply is at that point. So, I mean, they're basically, these new entrants are being held to the average, which is in contrast then to case study C. So these are existing dairy farmers, Glenbey society members, maybe multi-generation supply, Glenbey supplier members, society members, and they're limited to whatever cows that they have currently, maximum growth rate of 5%, as Sean has said. So if you're milking 50 cows at the moment, you can only increase by 2 or 3 cows per year, whereas maybe your neighbor might be a new entrant and they can come in with 100 cows. So, you know, the words, you know, fair, equitable, transparent has been used a lot by both John and Sean, but some farmers are questioning how fair and equitable this actually is. Moving on then to case study D. So a prospective new entrant to dairy, but who is not currently a Glenbey Co-op member, will not get a milk supply agreement. So that's those maybe that are currently in beef farming that don't have shares in the co-op. They will no longer be able to join Glenbey for the duration of this scheme. And I suppose depending on where they are in terms of location-wise, they may or may not be able to enter milk at all.
Now, various measures and ideas were floated to help curb milk supply during peak months. One of the more controversial ideas that farmers thought about was from Chagas's Joe Patton, who discussed changing calving patterns.
So look, at the issue, I suppose, is that when we talk about a change in calving pattern, Jack, it's not an insignificant change that we need. In fact, if you're talking in a growth context, which is maybe where a lot, that's your 30%, you can see still more milk at peak. So just click on through, Aidan, and we go again. So that if you talk about, if you wanted to say grow by the herd by 20%, Jack, and not produce a whole lot more in those months, you would require a shift towards 55% autumn calving, right? So you would have to not only calve the additional cows in the autumn, but you would have to take some of your spring calving cows and push them into the autumn as well. So it's not just for context. And I think I just want to get that point across to people, understand the scale of calving pattern difference that would be required if we talk about an autumn calving solution here. So just go again there, Aidan, if you go through once more. If you're talking about, that's your typical block autumn, and that's probably what underpins the issue here, is that, as you can see, that's what all your cows calving in September and October relative to the spring calving component there. They do have a significant amount of sort of late lactation milk. And typically, just talking to Aidan Lawless in Johnstown there over the last day or so, Aidan's autumn calf cows are still doing 24 kilos of milk at the moment. So that tells you why shifting to a lot of autumn calving, it has a moderate enough effect. So just maybe one more, Aidan, as we just for illustration, again, like really, if we're talking about growing numbers, this is just for illustration now. This is not sort of a suggested thing by Chagas by any means, but as an illustration, you really would be talking, if you want to avoid any additional peak growth, you're talking something like 50%, 50 to 55, 60% autumn calving, or indeed starting to calve in late April into May and June, where you're basically bypassed the spring peak altogether. Now that does come with significant costs. So
Director of Strategy in Glenbey, Sean Molloy, reiterated that Glenbey had hoped to avoid restrictions to milk supply.
Okay, there's two pieces there. So on the next steps first, Jack, so what we have been doing since we made this announcement last Monday week is we have been out with our council in the first instance and then meetings with the representative structure every night last week and this week, and it'll continue for the next two nights. And indeed, they've been very beneficial to us because we've been getting feedback from the representative structure and observations on what we put in place. And that, of course, will be reflected on when we finish those meetings. This week, then, there will be a letter going to farmers. It's on its way today, in fact, to farmers, which will outline all of the details. And there are quite a few, Jack, in what we've proposed in terms of both the retirement scheme, which we haven't spoken about much here, and the peak policy scheme as well. So that detail will land with farmers this week. It will set out all of the criteria and the implications, and there's a Q&A document with both of those as well, which tries to answer a lot of the questions that we've gathered from the representative structure meetings. Following that then, Jack, in the days that follow that, we will be then sending a correspondence to every farmer which sets out their allocated base reference volume so that they will know exactly what volume they have been allocated based on their historic supply. But also, and very importantly, it will show for the peak months, for the 3 years in question, what they are entitled to supply as per the current situation. So it'll be a very clear letter to you, for example, Jack, saying April, May and June next year, the year after and the year after that, here's what you're allocated. In addition, alongside that, Jack, they will get a form for those who believe they have a genuine case to complete and make their submissions to the appeal. So that one letter going to be, it's on its way today. Another one then will follow in the following days with the detail of what we're proposing. And then just to answer your question on the commitment and the position that Glanbia is in, and our chairman may wish to expand on this. We have been very clear on behalf of our board to our suppliers that Glanbia has been since 2015 and is today still committed to accommodating the growth that our farmers want. And, you know, subject to whatever environmental constraints come out, and that's not of our making, we want to accommodate that growth. And we will continue, and are even in the context of this particular challenge, we are investing, as I said in my presentation, Jack, right now today in our facilities to try and maximise what we have today. And we are committed to making those continued investments into the future. We are going to do and are doing our very best to address this particular challenge. And I think I'll just make one build on the observations that John made in terms of why we are now out with farmers as opposed to 6 months ago. This is a very sensitive topic. This was before, a judge, a legal system. And indeed, the judge is not going to conclude until June in terms of his findings here. So that presents a very sensitive backdrop to any commentary that we might make. And I think farmers will appreciate that. And also over that duration, we were putting in place, insofar as we could, third-party arrangements for milk. So a lot of detailed work was going on. It's not as if we were just waiting for an outcome in the background. But insofar as that issue can be addressed, and we are going to fight hard that it will be addressed, we are committed to growth. Now, if I could just make one closing observation, Jack, on this as well. This is an issue that's an Irish dairy industry. It's not just Glanbia. It's going to have an implication for all farmers and all processors. I would hope, Jack, that when people reflect on what we're doing and what the challenges we're facing, and to Justin's comments at the very start, that this issue will serve as a call to unite farmers, our farm organisations, our processors, to ensure that we're not found as an industry unfairly treated in a fashion that we can't grow and expand for the benefit of our farmers and indeed for the benefit of our economy. So we're not, as you articulated in the journal yourself last week, the villain in this. We are the folk that hope to unite the industry in trying to address the challenge that we're all faced.
Now, of course, these are just some of the snippets from the webinar, and you can go back to watch the full event on our website. Well, we're going to stay with dairy, but downsize a little to goats, an area where expansion is still possible, apparently, as we learned from Irish Country Living journalist Anne O'Donoghue, who spoke to Emma O'Connor about building her herd from 2 to 25 in lockdown.
Are you hand milking them, Emma?
Hand milking them, yeah, hand milking them. And I got a small machine and was hand milking from the back door at one stage. I'm milking 35 now, so it was kind of a fluke. I didn't even, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I definitely wouldn't even thought of owning a goat, never mind milking one, you know.
And where do you keep them, Emma? Just in your own kind of garden there?
Oh, a neighbour had a field directly behind our house, and I bought 2 acres off him, and we just farm on the 2 acres, and I have sheds and all just at the back of the house, so it's all here kind of in one square, so it's kind of enough.
And that was obviously, like, that was obviously, at what point did you decide you were kind of going to get serious enough into it? Because obviously you bought a little bit of ground and you'd put up sheds and things and I assume a parlour and stuff.
Yeah, it kind of, it happened kind of so quickly that we kind of, we got the two, I can't even think of what year it was now, but I kind of, when it got to 10, and we were at that point, people were kind of saying, geez, maybe we'll make a go of it, and kind of, that's when I started the Instagram, and people would come and see where their milk is coming from, and where it was all, we decided then that we process it ourselves, so we built a parlour, we literally built everything from scratch, built sheds, parlour, we're currently building a processing room, it's a long, long road, but we're hopefully getting out, so we'll make cheese yogurt and everything here on site, and hopefully have a farm shop, hopefully this year, and just kind of build it up that way, you know.
Brilliant, Emma. Jesus, that sounds great. And just, I just want to get into, I suppose, have an idea of the times. When was it that you kind of finished the course in Kildalton?
So it was, so maybe 5-6 years ago, so that was in 2015, maybe 2016.
Yeah. That you finished up. And when?
Yeah.
And then some time later, you kind of started, I suppose, decided to get into it a bit more seriously.
Kind of, yeah, a bit more seriously. We kind of look into it, as I say. We were just, I do all the outside work, and Mam was really interested. She's interested in food and kind of nutrition, and she kind of looked into the milk, and we were just doing it in our home kitchen, and we said, God, if we were going to do it, we might as well. It's as handy to milk 10 as it is to milk 30, so we said we'd build it up that way, and she said we'd build a processing room.
When did you put in the parlour?
We put in the parlour, it would have been fairly soon, so maybe 2016.
Yeah.
And we're currently building, I hope it should be finished by now, but COVID has put a stall and everything. We have a second bigger parlour now that we're putting in, so at the minute I'm milking, so 7 go into a headlock at a time, and I just have a portable machine with 4 clusters.
Okay.
And we're currently milking and putting in a new parlour where I'll be milking 8 at a time and 16 in.
Brilliant. So, and will that be a proper swing parlour kind of?
Yeah, proper. Yeah, it would be like, it's basically a cow parlour, just on a smaller scale, you know.
Oh, brilliant. That would be so exciting.
Yeah, it will be. And it's a long, because we originally planned for that 4 years ago, but it's been a long road to get there. And we, every year we're like, right, this year's going to be it. And then something else comes up. So hopefully, it's going to be this year. That's all I keep saying.
And where do you sell to, Emma, or?
So at the minute we're just using the milk for ourselves, and I feed it back into the kids.
Yeah.
Whole milk, and then hopefully in the summer we're hoping to start up our own farm shop.
Yeah.
And sell direct from the house, and maybe some local artisan shops in the area. But we're trying to mainly from ourselves.
Stay tuned, because we'll be back after this.
Will climate targets force a cull of the national herd? For more in your Farmer's Journal, here's Paul Mooney.
We examine what the climate bill will mean for farmers. Will you gain or lose money earned at cap changes? We look at what it means for your farm payments. €250 per hectare straw chopping scheme opens. We have the details, plus 4 pages of analysis and reaction to Glanbia's new milk supply quota.
And don't miss your free Easter food magazine inside this week's Irish Farmer's Journal, on sale now.
Now, many of you this week will have heard about the Climate Action Bill, which will set legally binding targets to ensure that Ireland has net zero carbon emissions by 2050. On top of that, there is a framework for reducing emissions by 7% annually starting this year and reaching a 51% reduction by 2030. Now, many farmers are fearful that given agriculture is responsible for 34% of all emissions, the highest of any sector, that they will be hit the hardest. Well, there is some good news in that the actual targets for each sector are yet to be decided, and a public consultation is now open where all citizens can have their say until May 18th. The Minister in charge of climate action and Green Party leader Eamon Ryan had this to say at the Tuesday press conference on the subject of the climate bill in regard to farming.
And in agriculture, yes, all those changes in ag climate are going to need it, but we're going to need to go further. And it will involve new investment in forestry, so it's a stores of carbon as well as sources, sinks of carbon. And we will do it, as I said, it's nature-based solutions. It's rewetting our bogs and storing that carbon in those bogs is a very practical, realizable way. We've just this year already put 150 million into that. We're like, this is happening in reality already. We put a quarter of a billion into retrofitting homes this year. We put that 360 million into active travel. We put that 150 million into rewetting bogs. Like, we're doing it at scale and learning from it, and we will be good at it. I'm confident.
Eamon Ryan there. And of course, we've a lot more on the climate bill in the paper this week. Now, if you would like to make a submission as part of the consultation, you can email climateconversation@decc.gov.ie. That is climateconversation@decc.gov.ie. Now, blackgrass is becoming a major issue on tillage farms across the country. Here, Stephen Robb talks to Chagos' Jimmy Staples about how to spot blackgrass in your fields this spring.
Stephen Robb here, and I'm delighted to be joined by Jimmy Staples, Naval Conservation Tillage Project Manager with Chagos. So, Jimmy, this is week three of our year-long blackgrass campaign. This week we have a detailed article between the two of us in the paper focusing on blackgrass identification. Now, to be brutally honest about it, anybody who can't identify adult blackgrass at this stage in a field, they really need to ask themselves some serious questions. It's one of the most distinguishable weeds that we have in Ireland. But it's a completely different story whenever we're talking about blackgrass in the vegetative stage, which is a large part of the focus of this week's article. It looks like a grass, and it's quite hard to distinguish from some of the other grass species and indeed some of the other crops that it will be mingled in with. So I suppose, Jimmy, to begin, you know, if someone's out walking the fields over the coming days or the coming weeks, what are they looking for, or where do they even start?
Yeah, it's a good question, Stephen, because it's like you say, it can be quite difficult to distinguish from a lot of the different grasses and a lot of crops you'd have grown as well. So, I suppose really you're looking out for something that looks a little bit unusual, I suppose, as opposed to the crop you're walking through. So, what you'll find is you're generally going to find, if you're walking through a crop at this time of year now, it's winter wheat or winter barley, you're looking at probably getting towards the end of tillering and possibly into stem extension. So if you're looking for something, it's going to be that little bit behind those crops. So it's probably only started tillering at this stage, early tillering stage. A lot of blackgrass you'll find are getting into a strong tillering, I suppose. So where you're looking at it, the plants themselves will be a growth stage or two behind the crop. So you're looking at something that's going to look out of place for one within the crop that you're standing in. The blackgrass leaves themselves will start to have that bluish green color to them. They're going to be very slender. They're going to have a nice little twist in the leaf, which is very, very easy to identify, you know, and they'll have that sort of, once you get down and you spotted something that you're not familiar with, say, okay, I'll have a look down and see what that is. You try and pull it up with the roots and have a look at towards the base of the plant. This time of the year, you should see a purpling on the leaf sheets and up at the base of the stem and up along the leaf sheets. You'll also find the leaves would be very slender and smooth. You know, there'd be no hairs on it like you would find on a brown plant, for instance.
You see, that to me is at this time of year is the key behind this all, is the purpleness at the base, because that is pretty unique, sort of, isn't it, to blackgrass, and you instantly know what it is. Now, the problem is, as the days go on, the weeks go on, that purpleness begins to fade, doesn't it?
It will, as the plant matures and it comes out of that tiller and into stem extension, it will fade. The one thing I would say, ryegrass will also have a purpling at the base, but the purpling on the ryegrass tends to be a lot more, for want of a better use, it's brighter, it's more richer looking than on the actual blackgrass. But the blackgrass one will like you say, will start to fade now as we're coming into later in the season and the plant starts to stretch out.
Okay, so then I suppose, look, we've covered this before, blackgrass numbers are on the rise across the country. I suppose if we look about how blackgrass migrates from one field to another, does that give us an indication as to where to start looking, I suppose, or where's the best place to look for blackgrass as such?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. So we've come across a number of cases where blackgrass has come in on machinery, a lot of probably imported from the UK, maybe where they have a serious problem over there with it. So, you know, when you're starting up a combine or you're starting up the baler, it tends to be either in the gap or very close to the entrance to the field. So that's always a good place to look. And you'll tend to find a number of, if seeds have been shaken down off the baler or off the combine, you're probably going to find a number of them there. It'd be unusual just to find maybe one. You'll find a sort of a little bit, maybe not a patch, but you'll find a few plants together in that scenario. But blackgrass is unusual. I've been to a number of fields, and for the life of us, it's very hard to try and actually pinpoint exactly how it got into the field, given the location of the actual patch in the field. Mm. You know, it's coming in, it's on a headland, or it's down along the far side of the field on the far headland by the ditch, you know, and you're just thinking, how did it start there? And it's nowhere else in the field, you know, so it can be.
Yeah, because the machinery is not the only cause, isn't it? I mean, it can come in UK seed that has been found. That's true, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, when you've red label seed coming in from the UK, there's a tolerance in that for blackgrass seeds, whereas Irish seed that's produced in Ireland has a zero tolerance for all the main grass weeds, whereas with your red label coming in from the UK, there's a tolerance for most of those grass weeds, including blackgrass. So potentially it could come in that way. We've heard reports of stuff coming in organic fertilizers as well. Generally, you can probably chase it back to straw in that fertilizer, which has blackgrass seeds in it. So
I suppose, look, as the crop, your commercial crop, continues to develop and mature, so does the blackgrass weed as well. So as the blackgrass matures, what are you looking out for? When will it begin to overtake, we'll say, the height of the barley or the wheat or whatever, and when will you notice it, whenever it starts to mature as such?
Yeah, so in those winter crops like the wheat and barley, you'll start to see blackgrass starting to emerge above the crop in probably early May. Now it can be quite difficult to see while the crop is still a healthy green looking. And the blackgrass heads themselves will be a nice green colour. So actually, unless you're actually down looking across the top of the crop, it can be quite hard to spot them. It's only when they start to mature and the seeds start to ripen in the head as you're getting towards the end of May and into June where you'll really start to see that real deep purple colour that the blackgrass heads take on as the seeds mature.
Okay.
If you're anyway concerned at all, you know, you need to suppose to be spotting it as early as possible in order to prevent, because seed will start to be shed from probably early to mid-June onwards.
So I suppose really by the time it becomes so notable and so obvious that it's in your face, it's too late, you know, it's a fire brigade situation then.
Yeah, exactly.
So I suppose to conclude, like, what's the message to everyone who's listening here today in terms of spotting blackgrass good and early? What would you say?
I suppose if you have any concern or if you spot something that you're not familiar with, don't just brush it off. Get down and check on it and see and try and establish exactly what it is. It could be nothing, but it could be something major. You know, and I know it can be quite hard to identify it at this sort of vegetative stage, but you know, once you start getting into April and end of April, start of May, you're going to start seeing heads come above the crop. So you know, you just get in your crops, walk your crops. If you have any concerns at all, just be extra vigilant, and if there is something there that you're not sure about, get someone to identify it for you, whether it be your local advisor, your local merchant, your local Chagas advisor, or you know, you can contact myself as well, and I'm sure yourself too, Stephen. You know, there's plenty of help out there to get these things identified now at this stage.
Brilliant.
So, but accurate and early identification is going to be key to prevent this becoming a problem. So.
Okay, well, you can read all about spotting blackgrass at an early stage and at the mature stage in this week's Farmers Journal. Jimmy, thanks for talking to us, and we will talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Stephen.
Stephen Robb there. Now that's it for this week. Thank you very much for tuning in. I'm Hannah Quinn Mulligan, and the sound engineer was Claire Nash.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.